This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. My name is Peter Higgins and I'm here today with my co-host Henry Viola Hare, and we have a very special guest. We have Joe Winkley, the head of capital markets at Winterflood. We've got a special podcast for you, ladies and gents, around the world. We're going to talk capital markets. What a way to start the day, Joe. Brilliant for you to join us. We're going to talk about capital markets. We're going to talk about access to markets. We're going to talk about the Winterflood wrap platform. But first of all, Joe, Henry and I love to know about the actual individuals we're speaking to so we can introduce them to our global audience. I know you trained as a solicitor, but I want to know a little bit more about your background prior to joining Winterflood in 2013. Just give us a little synopsis, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, Pete, Henry, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate it. So I would love to say that I had a really thought through route into capital markets. I didn't. The whole thing was completely random. So as you said, I started off as a lawyer. I worked in both kind of debt capital markets and equity capital markets, but I also worked in M&A and I did a lot of funds work as well. And what then happened was actually completely random, which is I was sent on a secondment to one of my clients, which was the fund manager Fidelity, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And I worked effectively as a kind of in-house lawyer at Fidelity on secondment for a while. And while I was there, it became very clear to me that A, I really wasn't very good at law, and B, I really didn't want to go back to my original job. And so I started applying for any job that I could think of. And I was very lucky that I got a job at what was then Dresdner Kleinwort Wasserstein, so the old kind of Kleinwort Benson business. And I started off in their kind of emerging companies, smaller companies team, but with a real focus on investment trusts. And I'd never really come across investment trusts, but a kind of link from sort of Fidelity through to investment trusts, that kind of set me on my way. So I started working in corporate finance advisory with a real focus on investment trusts. So this would be sort of early 2000s. From Dresdner Kleinwort, I then moved to UBS, where I ran the investment trust team at UBS for a number of years until the financial crash. Then I moved to a company called Oriel, which is now Stifel. And I carried on, so a number of my team joined me there, and I carried on covering investment trusts until 2013 when the phone call came in from Winterflood. So I originally joined Winterflood as head of corporate finance, again, with a focus on investment trusts, with more of a kind of, at the time, there was a real boom, as you're aware, in kind of alternatives, IPOs for alternative funds. So I then started getting much more focused on the kind of capital market and fundraising side. I did that for a number of years, ran the investment trust team at Winterflood, and I'm still responsible for the trust coverage here. But in the last probably 2 to 3 years, my focus has moved on a bit, which is more into the wider retail space. So acting, and you mentioned wrap earlier, and we can talk about it later, but really acting, working with corporates to enable distribution into the wider retail market. And this is via the kind of intermediaries that we'll all be familiar with. So the platforms, Hargreaves Lansdown, AJ Bell, Interactive Investor, these kind of guys we work with to provide access to new issues and fundraisings.
Brilliant synopsis. Thank you ever so much for covering that. So I've got in my notes here that you 15 years experience thereabouts, investment funds, and advised on over 10 billion in fundraising. Joe, yeah. That's quite extensive experience you got there.
It is. No, I mean, it's sad to say that a lot of that is historical. I mean, as you're aware, the fundraising market has been, it's been in the doldrums for the last few years. And certainly the IPO market, we haven't seen much. And the investment trust market in particular, been very limited fundraising. So it would be great if that comes back. I can't necessarily see it sort of motoring in the short term, but longer term, I still think there's a lot of life left in the UK capital markets. But unfortunately, yeah, a lot of those creds are historic creds rather than current ones.
Absolutely. I was just reading a piece of research today, and I'll quote this for you. You mentioned Fidelity just earlier. Research by Fidelity International notes that direct investing in equities peaked among British savers during the 1999 dot-com bubble and never recovered following the bust. So one of my questions was going to be when we start speaking later was regarding the fundraising and the success you've had, but we'll cover that a bit later on, Joe. So what I want you to do at this stage is speak about the changes before we get into the speaking about the wrap. And the big change, obviously, is the completion of the deal December the 1st regarding joining the enlarged group of Marex, which is a 3.76 billion market cap US listed company. How has that changed? How has that widened the reach of what you're offering at Winterflood, et cetera? Just tell us a little bit about that. And then that's, encapsulated the drive going forward for retail access.
Look, it's a great question. And again, just to kind of put this in context for your listeners who are not aware of the kind of the background of Winterflood. Winterflood has been around for about 30 years. So it was founded by a gentleman called Brian Winterflood, who unfortunately is no longer with us now, but he was a very big name in the city. And one of the things that he championed was retail inclusion, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But that was his real focus, and that's really the kind of the lifeblood of the Winterflood business is providing access to the likes of you and me. Two capital markets in it, all the way through from small caps to FTSE 100 into ETFs and bonds and all the kind of things that you and I would want to buy and trade on a regular basis. So for a long time, Winterflood was a wholly owned subsidiary of Close Brothers. And again, you'll probably be familiar with Close Brothers, which is the kind of UK merchant bank lender. In recent years, for those of you who've been following the Close Brothers story, there has been more kind of financial distress, particularly around the car loans mis-selling. And Close was in a position where they chose to sell off some of their assets, and we were one of them. So as you say, as of the 1st of December, we are now part of Marex Group. If you're not familiar with Marex, it is a large financial services company that covers a range of different jurisdictions. So it's not just UK, big operations in the US, big operations in Europe, 40 offices worldwide, with a real focus on trading and liquidity provision across a wide range of different asset classes. So it's got a very big commodities trading business here in the UK. What does that mean for us? And so I think the first thing to say is that certainly in the short term, it is business as usual. We are not going to be rebranded. We are still going to stay as Winterflood. But I think looking sort of slightly further out, I think there are real opportunities to expand on what we're doing with Wrap in the UK. So, again, what are we focused on? We are focused on retail distribution, connecting companies to the end retail investors. But there is no reason why that has to be a particularly UK thing. So there are the equivalents of Hargreaves Lansdown and others in every jurisdiction out there. And I think there are particular opportunities in EU jurisdictions. And part of it could be bringing big European IPOs to you as UK investors, or to us as UK investors, or it could be taking UK IPOs and distributing not just to UK retail, but actually to sort of wider European retail. And we're exploring all of these at the moment. But I think the big opportunity for us is having a backer that is, it's a very successful company. Marex is very profitable. It is ambitious. It is certainly my impression so far. It's very entrepreneurial. It is it's a young but very ambitious business, and I think to the extent that that provides opportunities for us to take what we've been doing here in the UK and build on it in the UK, but also build on it ex UK, that could be really, really interesting.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Now, I'm going to ask you this just to just expand for our listeners about the Winterflood's retail access platform. We've been mentioning it already, Wrap. Just expand on that, and how could us as ordinary investors, access it, utilize it, engage with it?
So What does Wrap do? You may already have used Wrap without necessarily knowing it. So what does Wrap do? Wrap effectively acts as a retail aggregator. So what does that mean in practice? Let's run through an example. You are a listed company, and you want to do a fundraising. And typically, the first port of call for a fundraising would be to your institutional investors. And so you would go to your institutional investors and say, "We are looking to raise, let's say, 10 million quid." If you go back maybe 10 years, that would be the end of it. You go to your institutional investors, you'd raise your 10 million quid, you'd probably do it at a discount to market to make it a bit sweet for the institutions coming in, and then you would print the trade. And all of us as retail investors would not have been given that opportunity to participate. So what Wrap does is it fills that gap. So the reality is that if you are a bulge bracket bank or a large broker, you are not going to want to deal with the kind of fragmented retail market. We connect to somewhere between 150 and 200 intermediaries. And then on a look-through basis, we worked out that is probably about 14 million individual investors. So what we can do is we can go to the company and say, "Okay, you want to do your 10 million fundraise. Why don't you take 9 million from the institutions and actually give a million to your retail investors," as an example. What we then do is we have got an electronic portal which can be accessed by all of the major platforms, a wide range of intermediaries. And what they will then do is typically they will send a ping to you. If you're an existing shareholder, you will get a ping saying XYZ Corporate is doing a fundraising. It's at this price. If you're interested in participating, click here and put in your demand. And these offers can be, sometimes they are done by way of ABBs, which are accelerated book builds after hours. They can be as short as 2 hours, between 4:30 and 6:30, so outside of market hours. Or they can go on. We've had Wrap offers that have gone on for 2 weeks. And so it's variable how long they're open for. But the model is the same, which is that you as an individual investor put your order into your intermediary. So you would put your order into Hargreaves Lansdown or AJ Bell or whoever you're set up with. They then aggregate their demand. They put it into the Wrap platform, which then aggregates demand from everybody. So we are effectively on a look-through basis connecting to a wide range of different individuals. And some of the deals we do can be quite small. We can do small deals for AIM and Aquis companies where they only want to raise a few hundred thousand, all the way to many, many millions for larger companies and investment trusts. So that's the model. As I said, it's very, we make it easy for the companies is the aim. They don't want to be trying to connect to everybody. So we act as that kind of interface where we can open up the offer, we can open it up to all of the retail market, and then we can aggregate that demand.
Brilliant. You covered quite a few of my questions. I'm going to hand over to Henry now for a few more in-depth questions. Go on, Henry.
Well, I love the sound of all of this, Joe. I mean, Wrap and institutional fundraisings, like you say, was something that historically people like Peter and myself, we would just never be able to get near. Unless you were bringing 10 million to the table, they didn't want to know. My question then becomes, if we're starting to get access as retail investors, there's two sort of angles here. One is that this sounds as though you're being diluted as a shareholder. So you've got a set number of shares in issuance. Presumably there's now some equity being raised. That's the instrument that's being offered. And a lot of investors, a lot of our audience, they don't really like dilution. They feel like it's degrading their ownership of the company. Now, what sort of things should they be looking for to know whether these fundraisers are sensible or destructive? Are there key signs that they can look for?
Yes and no. So I think it's a really good question. And coming back to what I said earlier, typically these fundraisings would take place at a discount. They don't always. I mean, as you probably know from the kind of investment trust world, typically you would raise money at or around NAV or a premium to NAV to make it accretive. But let's take a kind of a normal corporate. In order to raise capital, typically it will be at a discount. And then the question that you have as an investor is, do you participate alongside the institutions or not? And what should you be looking for? The reality is that every corporate will present this as an opportunity. There are some who are really quite open and say this is effectively a rescue issue. We need the capital. If we don't raise the money, then we're going to be in financial distress. And obviously that gives you one kind of signal. I think to my mind, the kind of things to look for would be what is the use of these proceeds? And again, we've dealt with a wide range of different issuers, and they will all raise proceeds for different reasons. But if you are looking for a kind of growth story, there is an opportunity. It could be a new drug trial has come through and that you want to back it. It could be in the mining world, a new mine is coming online and they need more capital. Those kind of things, you just have to take a view in terms of what is the upside versus the downside of coming in. I think some things to think about are, if a company is heavily indebted and is raising capital, is that capital going to be used to pay down debt? Because often they're quite clear in terms of the use of proceeds, and so that is one thing from the investor side to look at, which is what is the debt stack look like? Is the equity being used to pay down debt, and what is the nature of that debt as well? Because we've seen a number of companies take out things like convertible loans, which are based on market price, and so you can end up, it's called kind of death spiral financing. You can end up in a situation where a company's got that in place, and so you need to kind of look through what the fund's being raised for. And so I don't think raising at a discount per se is, to my mind, is a warning sign. Maybe raising at a very, very deep discount, that tells you something, because ultimately the institutional market is still going to price these deals, and as a retail investor, typically the price is driven by the institution, and then the retail gets access at the same price. So you're not being disadvantaged from a price perspective. But if a company comes out and basically says, "I need to raise money, and the only way the institutions will back me is at an 80% discount," that is something you would look quite closely at and try and understand why that is the only level at which the institutions will come in at. Whereas if it's a 10% discount, then that shows that actually the institutions are quite keen to put money in relatively close to share price. So those are a number of things. The problem is that with all of these scenarios, you have to, understand the company, understand what it's trying to do. So there's no one size fits all, but there are certainly things that, to my mind, would set more alarm bells ringing, and things that I would probably feel a bit more comfortable about if I was an investor in those companies.
And this is something that we had Annabelle from the AIC on a couple of episodes back, and we were talking about shareholder communications. And really, this comes back to the same sort of issue. What are the management team actually saying to you as an investor? Why do they want this money, and what are they going to do with it? And so this also sort of dances around the idea that some fundraisers are successful and some are less successful. Have you seen some patterns in your career whereby, some fundraisers are really successful, perhaps that you've done through RAP? And could you tell us a little bit about what those look like?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a number of things that can predict a successful fundraise. So we haven't quite got there. We've got here at Wins, we've got a team of data scientists who are very good at sort of crunching data and looking at things, and later we can kind of sort of talk through some of the data we've got on things like sort of retail trading behaviors and everything else. But one of the things that we're looking at is there a way that you can take any company and say, look, if you're going to do a fundraising at X percent discount, what could you generate through RAP? And I think we are getting there, and we're using some really interesting kind of AI modeling and everything else. But to answer your question, we're not there yet. But there are a number of factors that really do influence fundraising, and the first thing is actually how strong your retail register is already. So a lot of companies come to us and say, "Look, we really want to do a wrap offer. We really want to get retail engaged with our story." And then you look at the register, and it's only 5% retail. And then it's not impossible, but you've got a much, much harder task, because you have to build a retail investor base that is not familiar with your company. So you need to find these investors. So one of the key things is, if you have already got retail investors, you are likely to see an element of support, because these investors have already. They already understand the company. They've already bought into the company. They're already following the company. It's a lot easier to then convert those into new additional funds for that company. So I think that's the first thing. And I think the second thing, and this is where it's a bit harder, it does come down to the story, that there are There are points where certain companies are very much in vogue, where certain themes are very much in vogue, where investors are very, very keen to back certain ideas. And this is not just, kind of in investment trusts, it's also in the wider corporate world. And so, over the last year or so, we've seen a lot of fundraisings for mining companies, for example. There's been a lot of interest in mining, a lot of opportunities in the mining sector. Prior to that, we had a period last year where there was a huge amount of money going into Bitcoin treasury companies, and they were really flavor of the month for a period of time as well. So you get these kind of thematic things coming through where retail investors are very keen to back stories that resonate with them at that particular point. So it's kind of putting those two together. As I said, if you've got a big retail following, you've got good retail engagement, and you've got a really interesting story to tell, then you can then sort of translate that through. It almost goes without saying that that is going to generate you the most demand from your retail investor base.
I really like that. I really like that answer. And you've just touched on something that I'm really curious about as well, which is this data, these data scientists that you've got.
Yeah.
Presumably, you guys see a terrific amount of data. I mean, there's one word that you've not used yet, which is market making, one phrase, market making.
So I probably should have said this much earlier on. In terms of Winterflood as a business, what I do is not the core Winterflood business by any means. What I do is a relatively new part of Winterflood. I'd like to think it's a growing part of Winterflood, but the core Winterflood business is providing liquidity in secondary markets. And so if you ever go online, and I'm sure you do, and you do online trading through any of the major platforms, we are one of the biggest, if not the biggest, secondary market liquidity provider to those platforms. So if you ever go online you've got that point where you click a button and you say, I'm interested in buying, £1,000 worth of Vodafone, whatever it might be, you click a button and you get a price to four decimal places. What has happened in that intervening split second is that Winterflood and a number of other participants have all put their best price in. So it gives you, as the end investor, the best price. What you'll see is actually if you're looking at the spread on a terminal, or you're looking at the spread on the screen, these will typically price within the spread. So you're getting a better price than in the spread. And that's because it's very competitive. So we put our best price in, everyone else puts their best price in, and you, as the end investor, get the best one to four decimal places.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
Now, this is where, as Winterflood, we have spent years and years building our own internal systems to optimize that pricing so we can capture as much order flow as we can. And so we do a significant amount of that retail trading, and that is the core Winterflood business. But as you said, Henry, what that means is we see an enormous amount of retail flow. And we can also then analyze retail flow that we don't actually trade ourselves. So let's say you go online, you do that Vodafone trade, but you trade with someone else. We will have given you a price on that. So we know you were trying to buy, we know the exact second you were trying to buy, and we know we didn't get that trade, but we know when it took place. And so what we can then do is go around the market, find that trade, if you did execute it, and build up a data set. So we've got a data set which looks at pretty much every single retail trade in every stock in the UK, and it goes back 7 years now. So we've got some really, really interesting data points there.
I love that. And I think this is something that, I mean, Peter and I have talked about it on a number of pods, but one thing that retail investors love hearing about is what other retail investors are doing.
Yeah, yeah,
what are they
yeah.
buying? What are they selling?
Yeah.
And so
it's
I'm
absolutely
really
fascinating.
Curious, what do you see in this data? I mean, retail investors have sort of got this persona of being quite reckless and gambling. You know, is that what you see in the data?
No, not at all. So we did a retrospective report. We've done two now. So we did one that covered 2025 in review, which looked at retail investor behavior. And this was actually picked up by the Times, because the conclusion was that actually retail investors are far more sophisticated than people give them credit for. And what do I mean by that? I mean spotting opportunities and actually being able to act on those opportunities. And so one of the case studies we looked at was the, if you remember, Liberation Day, Trump tariffs came in. And at that point, the FTSE 350 took a nosedive for a few days. It hit lows. And then it sprang back quite quickly when I think the market realized that maybe the impact wouldn't be as negative as people thought. What was interesting and was that at the point at which the FTSE 350 hit the lows was the biggest retail buying we saw in the whole of 2025. So you could not have timed your entry point better. Now there are things to bear in mind, which is that all of this was happening at the beginning of April, which is, as we know, is the new tax year. So was it luck? Was it judgment? It feels, the more analysis we do, that it's not luck, because you can look at it on a case by case. You can get into individual stocks, and we analyze different stocks. And typically, retail investors are very good at buying dips, and they're very good at selling at highs. And also, they're very quick to react. I mean, I know that people have got different investment strategies. Some are very much buy and hold. So we're not talking about retail investors in general, but what we're looking at is almost a kind of aggregation of all retail investor behavior. And I'll give you an example, which we picked up in our most recent investor report, which looks at Q1. And this was really interesting, and it was all around Trump's tweets. And if you remember, all around Epic Fury and Iran, I mean, it's still happening now. There's been volatility in the market. But what was really interesting is looking at how quickly the retail market turns. So we did 15-minute increments looking through that day. And I think Trump's tweet came out about 11 o'clock UK time. And the market was selling, it was selling. So we're just talking about execution-only retail here. This is it. So these are platforms selling, selling, selling. Tweet comes out. Suddenly turns green within seconds. It's amazing how fast the retail market can respond to news. And so, to come back to the question, we hear it as well. We hear it from issuers saying, why should we involve retail? It's hot money, it's flighty money. It's not. It is sophisticated money, and it's also long-term money. And again, some of the analysis that we've done working with retail platforms shows that typically, investors are there for the longer term. So some of the work we did with a major platform looked at every wrap deal we had done over a 2-year period and analyzed how many of those investors were still invested 2 years down the line. And I don't know, guys, what you would think the number would be, but it was about 80%.
Wow, it's a lot higher than I would have thought, actually.
Yeah,
So
and we
it's really good.
recently, I was lucky enough to host a panel at the LSE last week, and we had Interactive Investor on there. And the question was asked the same: what is the retention? And they've got similar numbers. Over 75% of investors continue to hold. And what is more interesting is that, and this comes back to this point around having retail drives more liquidity. Nearly 40% of those investors subsequently bought more in the market. So you're not only getting a sticky investor base, you're getting an investor base that is following that company and prepared to buy more shares in that company when the opportunity arises. And I'm sure if you think of your own investor behavior, those companies that you're invested in, those are the ones you're probably most focused on, and those are the ones that you are maybe more likely to buy. And what we don't see is to what extent are you out there in the pub talking about it with other people? Are you driving more retail demand? And does having more retail in there, really drive more retail? But certainly, I think all of the stereotypes around retail investors, we have yet to find any data that backs them up. It's almost the opposite, which is that retail investors actually act and trade in a far more sophisticated manner than anyone really gives them credit for.
That is
But no,
wonderful
no
to
one's done the
hear.
work on it. That's the thing, is that it's very easy to have stereotypes when you don't have the data. And it's only been in the last year or so that we're really starting to dig into that data and start to really expose how retail investors genuinely do behave.
That is music to our ears, Joe. Absolutely fantastic. You're obviously at the Investor Summit last year. Obviously, there's another one in September. We would love to have you come and share that data again
Oh yeah,
with us
that'd be
on
great.
September the
Yeah.
18th,
Yeah.
because we need to just demystify this and get rid of these stereotypes that Henry and I and other private investors, retail investors have, because we are sophisticated, we are long-term investors, we want to be involved, we want to participate, we want to engage, and that's what it's all about. This platform that we've got, which is Twin Peaks, is all about financial education, so we want to
Yeah.
carry on
And
that.
I also think, and again, I'm sure you guys are seeing this as well, that this is a really important topic for the UK at this moment in time. So,
Absolutely.
we are very underinvested compared to the wider G7 countries. I think we're the lowest. You look at somewhere like the US, where over 30% of people have got exposure to investments and equities, and the number I saw from I think it was an Aberdeen report recently was about 8% in the UK. So we are hugely underinvested. And what's interesting is that there is a genuine, it feels to me, shift happening. So part of what we were saying about how institutions used to freeze out retail, that no longer happens, or certainly happens to a much lesser extent. And what we've seen behind the scenes is the regulations in the UK have been changed to make it more easy for companies to include retail investors. And behind all of that, we have got things like the Treasury. I don't know if you've been following the Savvy Squirrel campaign, the
Yes, I
new,
have. Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
and you can take your own views in terms of how effective it's going to be, but at least people are trying to change things. And I think financial education is going to be a big thing going forward. I seem to remember reading somewhere that the government is going to introduce financial education into schools.
In schools, yes.
So all of these things are going to help. So I think c coming back to this point around the data, it shows that not only are retail investors important to have, but they are going to become more important. They are going to drive more liquidity, particularly as you go down the cap spectrum. If you are a FTSE 100 company, maybe it's less relevant, but when you get into the world of smaller companies, AIM companies, and these are really important for UK, these are the growth companies, these are the companies of the future. You can typically see retail ownership is 30% plus. So without retail, these companies are really going to struggle, and I think that is only going to be more and more important going forward. So I think, look, I'm a huge fan. I mean, my entire business is built around retail investors, and so I'm a huge fan of retail. But I think it's actually that it has been underloved as a really important part of UK stock market liquidity, and hopefully that's now changing.
Love that. I mean, it's so refreshing to hear somebody that is clearly so passionate about engaging retail investors, but has actually taken the time to understand what drives us and really looked at. I think one other thing that we've sort of skirted around a little bit is your involvement with investment trusts. So we've talked a lot about individual equities and debt raises for individual corporates. Could you tell us a little bit about the work that you do with investment trusts? You know, what does your day look like with an investment trust? What sort of stuff do you get involved with with them?
So on the investment trust side, my role is advisory. So I work with a number of investment trust boards, or rather, me and my team. I've got a whole team of people working with me to help investment trust boards with kind of strategic decision making. So this could be anything from things like share buybacks all the way through to sort of wider corporate action, whether it's M&A activity, strategic reviews, and in recent times we have been kept very busy by Saba, who have been involved with a number of the trusts. So we have a retained corporate client list. It's about 40 investment trusts where we are the retained broker. You'll see it on the RNSs, and those are the ones that we work with. And as I said, it's everything from helping them in the secondary market, having a sales team writing research on these trusts as well. All the way through to helping them with kind of corporate strategy. But my focus is much more on the corporate side, working with the fund managers. But we are employed by the boards, and so the boards are the ones that we really focus on.
Gotcha. And, you know, what is it that you think makes investment trusts particularly attractive to retail investors? Is there something that we should be looking out for? What do you like about them?
I mean, I'm biased. I absolutely love investment trusts. I genuinely think that if you want to pick the best way of investing in a collective assets, it's hard to beat an investment trust. And why? The reason is, in some ways it's very simple, which is that investment trusts, we all know about premiums and discounts. That is the safety valve for investment trusts. But what they don't have to do is provide ongoing liquidity like open-ended funds do. What does that mean? It means that over time, an investment trust should outperform pretty much any other type of investment, even if you're investing in the same asset class. And what's interesting, I don't know if you saw the thing recently by the AIC, but they did some analysis of basically fund management houses where they run effectively the same strategy in an open-ended and a closed-ended fund. And interestingly, the closed-ended fund outperformed. And why is that? Because, well, if you have to be fully invested, you're going to do better if the market's going up than if you have to hold cash, one thing. Secondly, you can gear. So you can actually amplify your returns using gearing. And then the final one is that you can invest in less liquid assets. And so that's one of the things I like most about investment trusts. So I mentioned earlier the kind of boom in alternatives, but you can invest in very liquid assets. You can invest in property, you can invest in renewables, you can invest in credit. But even within a diversified equity portfolio, you can go down the cap spectrum. And we've seen a number of investment trusts have an allocation to illiquids, even something with someone like Scottish Mortgage, one of the flagship trusts in the sector. That has got an allocation to private assets, and that really is interesting. It's something you can't get anywhere else. So I'd almost turn it around and say, well, why wouldn't you buy an investment trust? And I understand there are challenges with investment trusts. They are more volatile. You do see discounts and premiums coming through. But again, the way that I would look at it is, you don't buy investment trusts to trade them. You buy them as long-term investments. Pretty much all of my personal investments are investment trusts. And, I've accumulated them over years, and you just buy them. And if they do well, you keep them. And if they don't, you'll find another one that fulfills your need better.
Hopefully does better.
Yeah, but you've also, and again, I kind of mentioned my role at advising boards. You also have got that extra layer of protection. You have an independent board, and their one job is to look after you as shareholders. And my experience has been that the boards genuinely take their responsibilities very, very seriously. This is not something that they take lightly. And they are, whenever we are in a board meeting, they are really focused on how do we maximize shareholder value. Are we doing the right thing for our shareholders? And I think that's really important, and particularly at times of stress. And the investment trust sector has been under stress for the last few years. I kind of paint a rosy picture in terms of how great they are, but we have seen net retail selling. I mean, our retail report shows that last year there was over $1 billion of retail money that came out of investment trusts. Q1 this year, it's carried on. There is more selling than buying. So people are withdrawing money from investment trusts. I don't know why that is. I don't know what the drivers are behind it. Is it down to marketing? Is it down to concerns around discounts? Is it to do with concerns around activism? I don't have the answer. But it's not, it's not an area where I think the industry can be complacent. I think investment trusts are, to a certain extent, facing a bit of an existential crisis. What is going to save the investment trust is the retail investor coming back and buying, because that's where the opportunity disappears for the likes of Saba to buy at discounts. It's where you get more health in the sector, and it's where you can get more issuance coming through. But you can't just wave a magic wand to make it happen. I think there has to be a whole range of different factors, whether it's sentiment, whether it's performance. I don't know. But we do need retail investors to come back in investment trusts. Otherwise, the sector is going to continue to shrink for a while. I'm a long-term believer. The structure's great. And ultimately, people follow performance. And to the extent that investment trusts give you better performance over the long term, it should mean that they have got a viable future. But at the same time, I really wouldn't want to be complacent at this point in time. I think the whole sector is under a lot of stress.
Yeah, thank you for that, Joe. It was a brilliant reply. Obviously, as I said earlier, we had Annabel Brodie Smith from the AIC on the podcast a couple of pods ago, and she was saying that the investment trust board are now engaging far more with her and the team, have been doing for a couple of years. And you mentioned the advisory role that you have and the capacity you have, and you're working with 40 investment trusts. Are you also finding that they're actually accessing your services and requiring Winterflood's services
I think,
more so least recently because of the challenges they've been facing?
yeah, I mean, I think that in an ideal world, things would be going well. The trust would be performing well. It would be trading at either an acceptable discount or close to NAV. At which point, our role actually on the corporate side is relatively limited. You know, we would just go in and say, actually, there's nothing broken here. You don't need to change things. I mean, normally boards will have an annual strategy session anyway, even when they are absolutely fine, because they want to just make sure they're not missing anything, and they want us to review what are others doing in the sector. Is there anything innovative happening? But to your point, I think there is a growing, I think it's always been there actually, but I think there is a growing recognition of the importance of retail. And coming back to what I was saying, you know, what I was saying about retail investors being the future investment trust, that is not just my view. I think that is a genuinely accepted view, and it is driven by what we've seen in terms of the overall retail ownership of investment trusts. If you take a longer term view than just the last few years, retail ownership investment trusts has gone up. And when you're a board member and you're looking at your register, typically you will see the major platforms right up there, often right in the top three, in some cases the largest shareholders, and it's impossible to ignore that. So I think the dialogue has moved on. I think Sabra has been a big part of this as well, which is, if you are the board of investment trust and or the manager of investment trust, how do you engage with retail investors in the right way? How do you sell your story? You know, a lot of investment trusts are quite nuanced in terms of what they do. They want to differentiate from their peer group. They want to get that story out to investors. But I think there is still a question in terms of what is the best way of doing that? What's the best way of engaging with investors? You know, all of these trusts are spending money on marketing. You know, fund management groups are quite sophisticated when it comes to marketing. But I think it's still fair to say that there's a real question in what is effective and what isn't. And I think you kind of said, where does Winterflood come into this? I think that's something where, going forward, I think we can help more, because we have got this data source that we think is unique in the market. We've certainly not seen anyone else who has it. It really helps in terms of identifying catalysts for retail investor behavior. And I'll give you an example. We did some analysis around Questa. So do you ever read the Questa column?
Yes, of
course.
And
I've
where,
present it.
yeah, and where there has been a tip on investment trust. And again, what is really interesting is that you can see an immediate uptick in buying. So these things have a genuine effect, and they don't just last for one day. It's not like a 24-hour uptick. When we're looking at it, it does come off over time, but you probably get 5 to 7 days effect out of a Questa tip, and it is positive momentum for the company. And that's just one example. There may well be a whole load of other things that we haven't really sort of worked through and thought through in terms of how do you engage with retail, how do you stimulate retail demand. I do think that things are changing, that, you know, things like social media, engaging in different ways, maybe, you know, more video content. I don't know, but I just think kind of thinking through much more around that retail engagement. And I do think that conversation has moved on at board level over the last few years. And I think that one of the things that Saba has done, which is a positive, is really bring home to boards how important their retail investor base is, how important it is to engage. And it's not just down to the boards, it's down to the platforms as well, to make that engagement for all of us easier, to get people to vote more easily, because sometimes there are barriers. And again, I think the platforms are moving in the right direction. I think they're doing a much better job. And I don't know if you've seen it from your own investments in terms of getting notifications, being able to vote, all this kind of stuff. It's getting better. But I think collectively, one of the real impacts of Saba's activity has been to get people to really focus on how do we engage with that retail investor base. You know, we need them at times to come out and support our trusts, but we need them anyway to come and buy our trusts and to be long-term holders.
Definitely created more awareness,
Yeah.
and you know, and the fact is that there, I feel 5 6 years ago there wasn't as much engagement because the shareholders were already there, and the nuance was they'll always be there. And now there's it's
Yeah.
created that, as you said, you know, 2025, 1 billion of outflows. We need to get that back into these investment trusts and build them up so they're sitting nearer to NAV going forward, you
Yeah.
know, and create more resilience of them.
Yeah, look, I totally agree. I think that is the aim. I think it's an aim, but it's also a challenge. And I don't think anyone quite has the answer at this moment in time.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer. the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEATS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe today using the TWINPEATS promo code, and you can save up to £69. Visit shareScope.co.uk for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
Sorry, go on.
Starts with a conversation. Well, I was going to say, I mean, we've talked about RAP, and we've talked about your retail access report. How can people get hold of them? How can people get engaged with this as investors? So people are sitting here listening to it. What do they need to do?
So the first thing to do is to go to www.winterflood.com/RAP, which is WRAP. So, and if you go there, I think towards the top of the page, you will see a sign up for notifications. And this will enable you to sign up. If you are only interested in things like investment trusts, you can choose the asset classes you're interested in. So you're not going to get spammed with every deal that we do. If you're interested in being spammed, you can, but you can select what kind of deals you're interested in. And then what will happen is every time a new RAP deal launches, you will be notified. One thing to say is that not everyone can participate in every RAP transaction, because companies have got the option of either making it available to existing shareholders only, or making it available to existing and new shareholders. And obviously, we don't know at the point at which we send out an email whether you are an existing shareholder. So you might see something come through and it flagged at the top saying for existing shareholders only. What you can then do is, if you're interested in participating, you can go to your own broker and then put an order through, and that will then get routed through into RAP. So it provides you with, we're not all sitting staring at screens all day. So it provides you with a little nudge if something's happening. So that's how you can do that. In terms of the retail investor report, I think if you go onto our webpage, I need to check, I think there is somewhere where you can sign up and ask for access to that. And we will review that on a case by case.
Brilliant. So Joe, can you share with us some of the recent deals and some of the successes that you've had regarding raising funds and also accessibility to retail investors? And the fact you've already mentioned that we are sticky investors.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the deal that I found most interesting recently actually was an investment trust deal, which was for Invesco Bond Income Plus. So again, I don't know if you guys follow that one, but that's a bond fund run by Invesco, it's been quite a success story. It pays a decent yield, and it has been trading typically at a premium to NAV. So we went out and we did, and this was very soon after, I mentioned earlier, regulatory change, after the rules changed, and that was at the beginning of January this year. So we went out and we did a placing and a retail offer. And what was interesting is that it was the biggest retail offer that has been executed to date. And the reason is that historically retail offers were capped at €8 million. So it's probably something I should have said earlier in terms of a barrier to retail engagement, that under the old EU rules, you could only do a retail offer without a prospectus, which is kind of most fundraisings, up to a limit of €8 million. So we had hit that cap a number of times, but this was the first time we did one without the cap, and we raised, I think it's about 11.5 million sterling for that fundraise. So that was something which was really interesting, and obviously that is a trust that has got strong retail engagement, so we expected it to do well, but maybe not quite as well as it actually did in practice. So that was a good transaction. I mean, I think the other area, and this is actually straying away from the world of equities, that has been really interesting, is that we have worked with the Debt Management Office, so the DMO, and they are responsible for issuing all of the UK's debt, and in particular, the gilt issuance. And historically, actually, I think you and I could have subscribed for gilt, but it would have been a very complex process involved, filling out forms, going to the post office. I don't actually know how you do it. I think gilts have always been open to retail, but it's been very difficult to do. So we've been working with the DMO to provide day one access to gilts. And we've now done 18 transactions. And what we've seen there is that the retail engagement has really grown over time. So, you talked about one of the themes or the themes we're seeing in terms of our retail investor report. One of the themes is people putting money out of equities and putting it into gilts. And that was to the tune of about 6 billion last year. So there's a lot of retail. And this is just execution-only platforms. 6 billion going into gilts. And we have seen that in terms of the wrap platform and the primary issuance where gilt transactions went from raising, and they've all been always been decent numbers, but up to maybe 10 million. And now last gilt transaction we did, we raised over 100 million. So there's a lot of money out there looking for gilt yields at this moment in time.
Let me just ask you a quick question there regarding gilts then, Joe. Historically, it's always been a large lower limit as to accessing gilts, whether it be 100,000 or 250,000, and sometimes higher than that. As a retail investor, has that been reduced so we can access it with
Yeah, well,
20,000 or 50,000?
gilts have always been the exception, actually. So you have always been able to access gilts. So if you go onto your Hargreaves Lansdown account, there will be a number of gilts that you can buy and you can trade. And so gilts have always been the fixed income instrument that we could all buy. It's fair to
Okay.
say that the activity in gilts really picked up when interest rates went up because
Right.
gilt yields are linked to underlying interest rates. And so at the moment, gilts are being issued somewhere between sort of 4 and 5%. And for government money, these are not bad numbers, particularly compared to what you might be able to get in your bank account. So I can see why it is attractive, but I think Pete, what you're alluding to is actually corporate bonds, where you're absolutely
Sorry.
right. So
Sorry.
in corporate debt, you're absolutely right. Denominations can be anywhere from 50,000 to 250,000, and unless you've got a very, very big wallet, you're not going to be buying 250,000 to eclipsing corporate debt. And that is one of the big changes that happened on the 16th of January, which is that the ability for corporates to issue corporate bonds in lower denominations was changed. And so ultimately, it's now a lot easier. If you are a big issuer in the sterling bond market, it's a lot easier for you to now include retail. So that is one of the things
Excellent.
we are really focused on. There has yet to be, it's going to take time to come through. So there's yet to be a corporate issue that has included retail as part of their institutional offering, but we are having a lot of conversations with issuers. We're having a lot of conversations with their advisory banks. It feels to me that this is it's a similar conversation coming back, Henry, to what we were talking about before, to the ones we used to have around equity, where you've got to get people comfortable, you've got to get them to understand that retail is not scary, that actually it's a real asset. But we'll get there. So I'm confident we will start to see retail issuance coming through in the corporate bond market, and that again could be really interesting because, again, right now, there are a lot of FTSE 100 bonds where it would be great to go out and buy 5% yields, household names, and I think retail investors will be really quite interested in that area.
It sounds to me,
Absolutely.
Joe, it does sound to me like someone like Rachel Reeves needs to stop faffing around with the panels and just call you up and ask what to do, because there's all this talk about getting retail investors engaged. It sounds to me like you've got all the right ideas here. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Look, I think I think to be fair to this government, putting aside a lot of other things, not least our retail investor report showed that the biggest outflows in the whole of the last year or so were in October last year, just prior to the budget, and I think we all understand why. There was a lot of uncertainty around at the time. But I do think, the regulatory changes have been positive. I think the initiative to try and get more retail investing, I think it's a very positive one. So I think there are a lot of kind of good things happening. But it is about making sure that, we do capitalize on them. And one thing that I think we really need is to see a little bit more deal flow coming through, because there haven't been that many good kind of high profile IPOs, things for us all to get excited about. So that's not something any of us can control, but I think there will be a kind of virtuous circle. There's been a lot of negativity around the UK, a lot of negativity around listings. When I was at the event last year, I think one of the things I was talking about was how many companies had left the FTSE and how many
Yes.
companies had left AIM, and we are still seeing a kind of net erosion of the listed market. And again, it feels to me that it's temporary, and we'll see an inflection point, we'll see a turn. But to me, that is you need both things. You can't just go out and tell people to buy stuff. You need to capture their imaginations, put really interesting deals in front of them, and get people excited about investing. And if we can combine both of those two things, then I think it can be really, a really interesting time.
I absolutely
Love it.
agree. It goes back to what you were saying earlier, Joe, though, is to build that investor base and have those
Yeah.
companies actually be marketed properly or more so, and more storytelling and more engagement. And actually, the company's actually building that retail base themselves and continuing to do so once they've got the money, and keep doing it and
Yeah.
keep doing it, and not just coming out once a year at the AGM saying, this is what we've done over the last 12 months.
Couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. And as I said, I think there is more focus on it now across the board. But there is a lot more that can be done. Things like, online AGMs, all of the things like Investor Meets Company, driving more retail engagement, really trying hard to get information through. At the moment, things like, annual reports, can be quite impenetrable, even for those of us who have, been reading them for years. Just being able to capture ideas, themes, differentiating factors, and present them in an easily accessible way. And that's not to kind of say that retail investors need things to be simple. I don't think that's the point. But I think it's more that there's a lot of product out there. There's a lot of different things that we can all go and buy. And at the moment, I don't know how much money is going into things like crypto, but at the moment, there is a there's a real competition for investor time and, beyond that, investor money. And I think that's where the battle needs to be fought. That, we don't have a finite amount of time. We need to get information quickly. We need to get the right information, obviously, and be able to make the right kind of investment decisions. And I think that is that, the onus is on the companies to really start thinking about what's the best way of doing that.
Brilliant. Love that response. Thank you, Joe. Henry, have you got any final questions for
Well, I was
Joe?
going to say, I mean, we've covered so much here, Joe.
We
My
have.
mind's buzzing. I suppose if there's a one or two things that you'd like to leave our audience with to watch out for when companies are raising capital, what would you like to leave our audience with?
I think, look, the first thing to say is, even though, in a way, what we are trying to do is to connect companies to end investors, always enter things with a degree of skepticism. If you get a ping through saying, company's doing a fundraise, don't just click on it because it looks like it's a discounted market. Try and understand why it's a discounted market. There will be some great opportunities for investment, and there will be some terrible opportunities for investment. And I wish that on a personal level, I was better at identifying
We all.
the two. So I think that, try and really, I guess one thing, try and really understand what a company is doing. And the longer you spend investing with a company, and the more you understand the way that the share prices behave and the factors that influence the share price and what is happening in that company, the more educated you can be in your decision making. And so I think it kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier. There are a whole load of reasons why a company will try and raise money. Some of them will be really positive and really good, and will make you returns over the longer term. And some of them might be more value destructive and or more necessary just to keep that company going. And I think, to the extent you can determine which camp they fall in, and it's not always easy, the better you're going to do in terms of your investment returns.
Love it. I
Absolutely.
love it.
Sorry, Joe, I was going to ask you a final question, really, in the sense of the platform, the Winterflood Retail Access platform, is product agnostic, I think is the word that you use historically. Can you just share some of the products that you will not be touching on and utilizing onto the platform so people know what will not be on there, and also where to find it again, please, so they can sign up
Okay,
for
so
the
so
platform.
where you find it, www.winterflood, like a flood in winter, .com/wrap, WRAP. And when you get there will be a website, but there's a button you can click to sign up, and then it's very it'll just take you through that. So that's how you get the information. You can see on when you sign up actually the list of things that we cover. And what we cover at this moment in time is everything that is effectively tradable and with a secondary market liquidity. And again, not all of these things. We go down to small caps, we go down to ACWIS, we go up to, FTSE 250. As I said, we do gilts. We will hopefully in the future do corporate bonds. But I think there are two criteria from our perspective. One, obviously, the product has to be suitable, and by that I mean assessed to have a target market for retail investors, i.e., the whole of market retail investors. And secondly, there needs to be some kind of secondary market liquidity there for as well. So when if you come in through a wrap transaction, you're not going to get stuck forever. But as I said, the liquidity does vary on a company by company basis. So that's one thing just to bear in mind when looking at these types of transactions. But for your typical retail investor, there would normally be liquidity there. So the kind of things that at this moment in time we wouldn't do would be something like a private market transaction. So I don't know if you've been following the Pisces rules that have come through. Those kind of transactions are only suitable for sophisticated retail investors. So at this moment in time, they are not supported by the likes of Hargreaves Lansdown and the other kind of pure retail platforms. I'm not saying we wouldn't, and I'm not saying that in the future the FCA may not take the view that these are available to a wider retail market, but I think we'd need to think about that and probably work with the retail platforms to understand that, because there are clearly more risks in buying private companies. There may be more opportunities as well, but there are certainly risks there. And one of them is the whole kind of lobster pot effect, that you do not want to be in a situation where you can get in but you can't get out. So at the moment, though, those are products that we don't offer. And as I said, I think anything where there is so things like open-ended funds, it's not suitable for wrap. They've got different things like LTAFs, again, not really what we do at this moment. So I would think of it as a very broad brush across equities and debt instruments that are traded in the UK on a regular basis. That's our sweet spot, and it gives us a lot to go after. I mean, I said
Absolutely.
the universe is shrinking. It's still a very big universe, and hopefully, while we're seeing a bit of shrinking in the equity side, we will hopefully see a whole load more corporate bonds coming through that you and I'll be able to buy. And at some point, I'm confident the equity markets will return as well. So, the more product that we can bring to you and your investors, the better. As I said, this is not me saying you need to buy everything by any means, but if you haven't got the choice, it means that your investment universe is more limited.
Absolutely. Spot on. Joe, it's been absolutely fantastic speaking to you. Ladies and gents, that was Joe Winkley, the head of capital markets at Winterflood. Joe, fantastic to have you on the program, and we'll see you again soon. Just stay on the line for me and Henry as we shut this down. But ladies and gents, we look forward to hearing your feedback for this podcast. And you can find Joe on LinkedIn as well. So find him on there and follow his articles that he shares, some really insightful articles, as well as the articles that come out via Winterflood. Henry, closing words to you, sir.
Just a huge thank you, Joe. That was a fantastic interview. And if anybody here is listening from an institution and hasn't spoken to Joe, I'd recommend picking up the phone and going and pestering him, because he sounds like a very bright guy to me.
Thanks, both of
Absolutely,
you.
Joe.
Really, really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Take care. God bless you, sir.
Thank you.
Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.